The following program contains heavy spoilers, deep insight, and absolutely no filters. Listener discretion is advised. Chubbs on film. Chubbs on film. Chubbs on film.
Chubbs on film. Welcome, welcome. This is Snobs on Film. My name is Arthur, your host, and I've got three special people with me: Isaac Perry, the Black Pen, and Jahan, first of his name. I'd also like to welcome Dr. Raquel Monroe, professor of dance at Columbia College Chicago. Her scholarship interrogates the performance of Black female sexuality in popular culture. What we want to do is we're going to talk about She's Gotta Have It, the 10 episodes on Netflix of Spike Lee's reinterpretation of his 1986 film. With the debut of his Netflix series, 10 episodes, 30 minutes a pop, based on the 86 film of the same name, we ask, does the success of She's Gotta Have It, plus HBO's Insecure, created by Issa Rae, and BET's Being Mary Jane, signal the advent of modern and authentic Black female representation on television? All right, Dr. Monroe, let me have it, because you're breathing, you're huffing, you're scribbling on the tablet we provided for you.
Authentic. Mm. That kind of implies like this monolith, you know? Like, what is what do we mean by authentic? I don't know that anything is ever an authentic representation of anything, because it's a representation of it.
Can there be representation of a portion of the Black female experience? Because I agree with you, nothing is monolithic. Nothing on television is monolithic of anyone's experience, of any group's experience.
So let me just, I'll put it out there first. I am an actual Spike Lee fan. I love his theatrics. I love the way he directs his films and all. I really get, I'm willing to suspend belief in reality and allow the people to float by and all the various things that he does. I love how he's kind of dumps everything on your head and then cleans it out as he goes along. I haven't seen everything, but I've seen 90%. I didn't see Chirac, for example. Mm-hmm. So
you and a lot of other people didn't see Chirac.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Did anybody around this table see it?
You know, no. I mean...
Did anyone on this block see it?
People scared us from it, right? Like, you're in Chicago and they were like, eh. So I just want to say that as my premise for not really caring for this She's Gotta Have It. I really, really, really wanted to like it.
Let me ask you, did you like the original film?
I did like the original film back then. You know, I liked it all except for, of course, the rape scene, you know, where he rapes the woman and then she ends up choosing him as her partner.
Right.
Like, you know, that was problematic. And he wanted an opportunity to redo that and retell that story.
Mm-hmm. Well, wait, before you jump in, I just want to get everybody's cards on the table. So, Jahan, did you like She's Gotta Have It?
Well, I enjoyed Insecure a lot more than She's Gotta Have It, pretty much on every level. The writing, the direction, the performances, the music, the look and the feel of the whole thing. I thought it did everything better. It didn't try nearly as hard, and it somehow delivered a lot more for me. But what I would like to say is that all three of the shows that you mentioned, including Being Mary Jane, none of them really have characters that I would deem to be likable.
Yes.
And that's cool in the context of like a thriller, but where part of the purpose of a show is to depict the everyday life of the characters, it gets difficult to stick with it if you find it hard to like or respect the protagonists. But yeah, for me, She's Gotta Have It was disappointing and was maybe marginally better than The Sweet Blood of Jesus, which I also saw.
That wasn't a Netflix series.
Vimeo.
That was that one that he crowdfunded.
Yeah. And distributed on Vimeo.
And you know, it's hard for me to say any of this because Spike Lee is a great artist. And growing up, his films meant a lot to me. I think Do the Right Thing, Mo Better Blues, Malcolm X, Clockers, He Got Game, they're great films. 25th Hour, Inside Man, really, really strong films. So it's with a heavy heart that I say this, but yeah. I think the problem here, as it almost always is nowadays, is with the writing. There are so many interesting ideas that are thrown out, but they never develop beyond slogans.
The first episode, I think, ends with Nola is basically speaking into the camera and saying, defining who she is. And then she's like, two fingers, Black Lives Matter. And it's like, it just, mm-hmm. it comes out of nowhere. And yeah. it's like,
nowhere.
Too heavy handed, too. Yeah. And it's like, what the hell? And it's like, come on. So
it's like they made her a caricature.
My issue with She's Gotta Have It, that really, I really wanted to like this a lot, because it starts one, two, where Brooklyn at? You know, like instantly mm-hmm, mm-hmm, he's mm-hmm. talking to me. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm, he's talking mm-hmm. to us. But that character, Nola Darling, is not likable. I don't mm-hmm. like her.
She was, to me, the less, of all the characters, she was the less defined. Like, I felt like she was the thing that everyone else bounced off of. So I knew more about Mars, Greer,
Jamie,
her, all of her friends. I felt like I knew more about them and less about her. Like, she was kind of like as Jahan says, a caricature, where it was like Spike kind of cut, okay, boom, she mm-hmm. wants this. And she made bold statements. She's like, this is what I want. This is who I am. Mm-hmm. Don't tell me that. Show me that through story.
Yeah, that was disappointing.
But that's his style. I mean, that's not new for Spike Lee. Spike Lee has always used characters and storylines as caricatures to make a larger point.
But some of this, I think, though, is you know, a lot of artists, a lot of the masters, if you look at their earlier work, mm-hmm. there was subtlety and nuance there. As they get older, and this is not just in film, I think this is in all the art forms, they start hitting you with like kind of a hammer, like a right over the head. It's almost like they lose their capacity for patience. They're just like, yo, this is what I'm trying to say.
I think it's possible here that, you know, with the passage of time and changing generations, Spike may have just lost touch with the type of characters that he's trying to write for now.
But he's not writing this show.
If he's the showrunner,
he's still executive producer,
and he's directing every single one.
Yeah, so he's getting the scripts, and if he doesn't like, he's going to change the scripts.
And see, and there's too much going on at all times. Like, it would have been really interesting to see this woman who is the street artist when she was attacked on the street mm-hmm. and then created the project out of that. Mm-hmm. Like, that was some really interesting stuff. That showed fear and vulnerability.
I felt like that should have been a whole episode.
Yes, that felt
like, because it was like, okay, the attack scene. And then I think it was the next day when she did those posters, and it was like, boom, boom. I wanted to see her go through the emotional thing of making the decision to do that.
Yeah.
Because I thought it was dope, the reaction that she had to go ahead and put that in her art almost mm-hmm. immediately. But I felt that it was glossed over a little bit.
That could have been the whole series. That could have been the whole 10 episodes. But there's this need to do all this other stuff. Mm. You know what I mean? And then she's over here. She's texting while her boss is talking to her. And it did feel a little bit like, are you trying to make fun of this girl? Like, what is likable about her?
Yeah, good point.
A protagonist doesn't have to be likable. But you have to be invested. You have to be able to root for them. You have to open up a door to allow your audience to invest in your protagonist, even if your protagonist is going to make mistakes. And even more so, you know, you have to do that because you know your protagonist is going to be making mistakes. And you know that there's going to be the point where the audience may kind of fall off. You have to give them that, open that door so they don't fall off. And I think in contrast, Insecure, I remember the first episode of Insecure, talking about not just the female characters, her boyfriend, Lawrence.
Yeah.
When they first introduced him, I was like, damn, I know that dude. Because it's like, you know, I know brothers like that.
Mm-hmm.
But I thought he was just going to be that one-dimensional type dude, just sitting around the house, whatever. Then I think it was in the second or third episode where he called one of his boys and was trying to, like, talk to his boy. Like, man, you know, I got some things going on. And his boy kind of played him off. And it showed, oh, they're going to tell Lawrence's story, too. So it was like there was a effort there from a writing standpoint mm-hmm. that we were going to have fully rounded characters. And I think that made a big difference between these two shows. I can't speak for Being Mary Jane, but I can speak for those two.
I don't know. I just viewed the whole thing differently. I never intended to need to invest in Nola Darling, the character. She's Gotta Have It isn't a title based on the need of Nola Darling to have something. She's Gotta Have It is really the surrounding people saying that about her.
People are trying to frame this within feminism or black feminism. This is a feminist film. I just find that really problematic and really want people to back off of that. Like, just don't try to frame it around feminism at all. There's an assumption that she's having sex like a man. If that is what makes it feminist, then that's really problematic. To embrace the patriarchy or to do things in the way men do.
Thank you.
Does not feminism make. Feminism should be working in some ways at some points to sort of undo patriarchy. to some mm-hmm. sense. But we can't limit feminism solely to sexual liberation. I did appreciate that she was with a woman, that he queered it up, because it's 2017, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And so I felt that that was really important. But I also knew that was going to come. That wasn't a surprise.
I think, though, my question about what Spike does involving feminism and sexuality is he's tried to explore these themes, and I don't think he's ever really gotten it right. I think back to Girl 6, mm-hmm. and the She's Gotta Have It, both iterations, She's Gotta Have It. And there's times I wonder, okay, is this gratuitous sex, or is this sex trying to make a statement, or is this just gratuitous sex?
Right.
Mm-hmm. There's points where it feels like, okay, we're in statement territory, and then boom, we're mm-hmm. in gratuitous sex. And I kind of sympathize with him in the sense that it's harder for filmmakers to explore those topics than, say, songwriters. Songwriters have been exploring these topics, you know, for a very long time, but within 4 to 5 minute stints.
Right.
Whereas when you have to write an entire film or an entire scene that explores that topic, I think it's a little bit more difficult, and you're dealing with the visual as well. And Spike, you know, I think back to Girl 6, and I remember going to see that at the theater and being excited about it because it had all the Prince songs. Yeah. And, you know, mm-hmm. it seemed like it was almost going to be like a homage to Prince's aesthetic and mm-hmm. Prince's ideology when it comes to, you know, sex and feminism mm-hmm. and all these other things. Mm-hmm. And I came out disappointed because I felt like, again, he got heavy handed with it. Maybe he should have had a woman come in and write certain parts or give him mm-hmm. some more insight into this, because I felt like there was just too much of it that fell short of what he was reaching for.
When you start with sex as the premise to explore women, it's automatically a setup. So when we're thinking about She's Gotta Have It, Girl 6, She Hate Me, you know, mm-hmm. all of these mm-hmm. where the protagonists are these women, but it is largely based in their sexuality and their mm-hmm. sex lives to begin with. There's opportunity that's missed there. It's all still surface. Mm-hmm. It's all still surface. There's no different type of sex that happens. Like, you have this opportunity to mm-hmm. do, if you're going to mm-hmm. be explicit, mm-hmm. to go deep and go explicit with mm-hmm. a different type of sexuality. We don't really see a different type of sexuality happening mm-hmm. in these investigations with these men. You right. know what I mean? Like, right. it's still the same kind of sex happening. Yeah. There's not enough. They could dive into S&M. They could dive into a whole bunch of things just around sex in and of itself that would make it gritty and dark.
Mm-hmm. I differ a little from where you're coming from, because I don't think it necessarily needs to be dark in that way, if we're going to use that word, but I just want whatever direction they choose to go in to be executed well, and, you know, not being superficial, not being on the surface.
But it's still in every aspect sort of hangs in the surface. That's a missed opportunity. If She's Got to Have It and you're talking specifically about sex, then let it be that. But I don't think they want to go that deep, because that's going to turn their audience off in a way. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But And that's also part of it, is it's trying to be far reaching and all encompassing. And that's where it gets weak. Like, pick your audience, pick a lane and go deep in that lane. Mm-hmm. Because right now mm-hmm. he's trying to talk to the millennials, and he's trying to talk to his peers at the same time. Mm-hmm. And
that's difficult.
We're not the same people. Mm-hmm. We don't have the same perspective. You know what I'm saying?
Nola says in the beginning, I'm not a sex addict. And her friends assert that she's a sex addict. To me, that was interesting, but it was just a statement. Right. It wasn't explored. It's like, show me that. Right. It's like, he's always been broad. You know what I'm saying? If you look at his characters,
mm-hmm. That's right.
There's always this wide array of characters. So I think that's kind of his creative impulse. Because I think if he would have handed this, and not to say I would not want to see Spike direct. I love seeing Spike direct. But writing is the genesis. Writing mm-hmm. is the origin. So, and there are some female writers he has on staff. I was looking through as we were talking.
Yeah.
Some females wrote some of these episodes. But again, since Spike was a showrunner, I'm sure he had his hands on everything. But it would have been beautiful to take this premise in 2017, and She's Got to Have It, and just hand it to some Black female writers, people of color writers, say, look, I want to see what y'all do with this.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? And then, you know, we'll decide what to do with it. But I want you guys to get the first crack at this mm-hmm. and take this and say, what does this look like through a female perspective, through a female lens?
Right.
And I think we would have gotten some of these questions that we have, especially with Nola. I think some of those would have been answered. Even if the series wasn't great, I think some of these questions would have been answered.
So do we think that those questions were answered with more sophistication by Issa Rae and Mara Brock Ali?
Absolutely.
I think so with Issa Rae. I wanted to hear your take as the person who's seen, I think you've seen all of Mary Jane. I want to hear your take on Mary Jane.
I haven't seen all of it, but I've seen the first few seasons. And I kind of bailed on it when I started to feel that the characters, or at least the lead characters, were making the same sort of mistakes over and over again. And it just got a bit repetitive to me. Mm-hmm. But I think it found its lane in a way that She's Gotta Have It didn't. I preferred the performances. I felt that the music fit a little bit better in Being Mary Jane. Mm. And I recognized the importance of the subject matter dealt with by Being Mary Jane some of the time. I remember Dream Hampton contacted Mara Brock-Ali on Twitter to say that she felt Mara Brock-Ali was doing really important work on Being Mary Jane. And her comment came after, I think, an episode which dealt with depression and feelings of isolation, which, judging by my Twitter feed, is something that way more people experience than I had any idea of. So it dealt with it in a very sensitive way. It dealt with it in a very real way. And, you know, that's important. That too is representation. Mm-hmm. But I sort of feel that She's Gotta Have It was more of an ad campaign, whereas Insecure and Being Mary Jane were TV shows.
I mean, an ad campaign like what? You mean like a series of glossed over commercials for a product?
That's more harsh than I intend, but yeah. Like, it was really proud to be associated with the concepts it claimed it was about, but mm-hmm. but a lot of it felt like, look at us, look at what we're talking about, rather than actually mm-hmm. just doing it. I mean, I'm sure it wasn't their intention, and I may well be alone in feeling this way, but this constant kind of just touching on this, touching on that without really getting a grip on it just felt more like advertising than filmmaking to me.
Absolutely.
But hey, where does Ava DuVernay's Queen Sugar fit into all of this?
Good question.
I haven't seen it, but Imani loves it. I don't know anybody who's seen it that doesn't like it.
This is a little bit of progress, because you remember back in maybe 70s or 80s, any black TV show that was on, every black person has seen it, because yeah. there weren't that many.
Right.
So at least now there's someone that, oh yeah, I haven't watched that, because there's, at least there's a small array.
That you have shows. Choice. With She's Gotta Have It, we haven't even talked about the other subplot that is happening in She's Gotta Have It, and that's with the beauty standards.
Like, Shemeka.
We haven't even talked about that yet. And like, and this is definitely where he goes to his farcical side, like Bamboozled. This is certainly the Bamboozled moment.
And I think that would have worked, like the Big Booty Show or whatever that was. That worked in the 80s. But now they're literally in the Instagram age. There's like shows and Instagram accounts that are basically just like that. So it's
well,
like,
that's what
it's
not as shocking. On,
but it's not, it doesn't work as satire.
Right. So the setup is her friend Sharmeka wants a big booty. It's hinted at that it's for self-esteem reasons. It's very explicit that it's for financial reasons. So she goes to a very illegal backroom clinic, using the term loosely, very loosely, to get this procedure, using the term even more loosely, done, which later on leads to a very serious medical emergency. So the question is, are the filmmakers saying she shouldn't have done it?
Right, that's
what. Or are they saying, no, it's cool if that's what she wants to do, but she shouldn't have gone budget with it. She shouldn't have gone backroom with it.
That's what I'm wondering.
What are they saying?
Yeah. What are you trying to say? Because are you using this young woman to make a, to moralize? You know what I mean? Which is problematic. Like, if you do this, this is mm-hmm. what's going to happen to you. So you shouldn't be doing this type of work. Like, some people are like, right. Well, it's a, you know, the show is sex positive. Is it sex positive?
But that was a good example, though, I think, of kind of what went wrong with the show, is that I think it was in episode 2 where you saw the stage dancers. And then afterwards, Shemeka says, she goes to Fat Joe and says, I want to be on stage. The whole purpose of that scene was to get to her to say that.
Yeah.
But the scene, the stage dancing lasted for 90% of the scene. And then 10% was her asking Fat Joe. It's like, why do we need to see that 90%?
Because that's his, and I'm not defending him because I don't like it either, but that's his stylistic.
In a movie maybe, but in a 30 minute show, if you only got that much time, I don't need to see, that was probably what, 4 or 5 minutes of those girls on stage.
I don't need to see generic choreography.
Throw me that for 30 seconds, then get to the meat of your scene.
He did the same thing in Clockers with Da Bomb 40 ounce prop and all of these, you know, repetitive commercials about the bomb to talk about the alcoholism and the madness. And
let me ask you this. If we don't, do we respect it when Keenan Ivory Wayans does it in, like, Don't Be a Menace to South Central while drinking?
Well, yes, because the entire project is presented as a parody.
No, let me ask you. When he jumps up And he's like, message, do we respect that? Because that's basically what Spike's doing here, right?
Right. Like Spike reveals the artifice. But, you know, the difference is they jump up and say message. You know what I mean?
Right.
So,
but that's my point. They make fun of the fact that they're making it.
Yes. Yeah.
It goes back to your Jar Jar Binks as the Sith Lord.
I don't know what that is. I have no idea.
But because of the presentation of Jar Jar,
what is this?
Completely right. Obscures
is this Star Wars.
Right.
Completely obscures the message that Lucas may have fully intended Jar Jar to represent. Correct.
But you know what this is, though, dog? Correct. Spike invented this. That style of storytelling, he should have walked away from it. This is what happens when you, again, because
that's what you were saying
somebody,
in the beginning.
Right, somebody else did it. Yeah. He did it, then somebody else bit him, you know, and did a whole movie. And it was a homage to his style. Right. It's like, dude, right. You changed the game.
Right.
Now, just like every great artist, you got to keep flipping it. This is what, look at what Miles Davis. He never, you know, let me keep moving forward.
Yeah.
It's like, I can't, Spike just keeps doing it. And it's like, dog, you've already done that and it's not hitting the same way it was in 89.
Okay, well, again, in defense of Spike, does a show need to be authentic in every area? Can it be authentic in terms of the characterization, their motivations, their personal demons, their drivers? But then,
right. Could I mean, I thought the club was.
Could we also allow it to have like a magic realism about it and its whole universe?
But see, magic realism is tricky because you're also grounding me in this universe of gentrification and colonization. So that's very real. There's nothing magic about that. So
it's almost like he couldn't decide which.
Right. So you got me there, but then you got me in this magic realism. It's like you can do it. I'm not saying it can't be done. I'm just saying I don't think he achieved it here.
So. I don't think anybody here at the table would dispute that he's a pioneer. And I don't think anybody at this table would dispute that he doesn't know what he's doing or he doesn't know how to make a film. I think that he's carrying a lot of baggage with him as he goes through these multitude of projects.
Okay. You know? That is fair.
Because he makes good films, even modern films. I mean,
he makes homages too.
The last favorite Spike film for me was Inside Man.
Yeah.
Which one before that was 24 Hours.
Which he did, but neither one of those.
He
didn't write either of them.
Yeah, those are great.
Right.
Those are great.
I enjoy Clockers a lot.
And Inside
Man. He co-wrote that, but he co-wrote that with the author of the book.
Right. Inside Man did a good job of, like we were talking about, going beneath the surface.
Right. No sex in that movie either. There were references for whatever reason.
Yeah. Yeah, but those were realistic references when the guys kept looking at the woman's
breasts.
That said something. So, yeah, I think that to your point, though, this is a new medium for Spike, you know, this 10 episode. So I feel like he did try to cram like a feature film length's worth of stuff in like 10 episodes. I mean, it's like it doesn't need to be that way.
Right. They're not short films. You're not doing a short film for each thing.
All right. Let me ask you this. Was Sharmeka just a plot device that the filmmakers used to push the beauty standard subplot? Did she serve any other purpose?
No.
Was she a rounded character in any other way?
Yeah, I believe she was inserted there to deal with what our views are. Like, in other words, she's got to have it applied to Sharmeka. What does Sharmeka have to have?
I mean, she gives Nola some realness to her life, but I feel like the character is just used as a prop for this beauty standard subplot.
Yes. It's her childhood friend that she has maintained a friendship, you know, with someone who has had different struggles than she, you know, like presumably they're the same age. She's has an immigrant parents or an immigrant mother, right? She's Jamaican So
those are all things around the character rather than like the words coming out of her mouth.
He is wanting to critique women for the various ways we desire to enhance our beauty, and that's problematic.
Is the very act of doing that problematic? Is it the what or the how?
I mean, go back to school days when it was about good and bad hair,
right?
The conversation, and I was in high school when that came out. But I mean, I had conversations with my peers, both male and female.
He handled that one a lot more. He handled that a lot better, though. He handled that a lot better. It was a lot. I think it was better fleshed out. I think the concept of hair in the Black community is a lot more potent than the booty concept. To me, a more interesting exploration in terms of booty would have been the fact that since She's Gotta Have It came out, and now the original She's Gotta Have It, and now the concept of booty has entered the American consciousness.
Right.
How did it enter the American consciousness? Not through Black.
Nope.
It entered the American consciousness through Jennifer Lopez.
Yep.
As soon as a woman, she's still a woman of color,
right,
but she was a woman whose color, whose tone was a lot closer to European than African.
Right.
So as soon as she enters the American consciousness, all of a sudden they're talking about a booty. Now there have been Black women on film with quote unquote booty for a long time.
Long time.
So to me, the more interesting exploration for this show would have been, how did that happen, and what does that have?
Yeah.
What are the ramifications of that?
Raquel, use a different word if you wouldn't mind than problematic.
Okay.
What would you say? Is it limiting? Is it is it assumptive? What would you say it is?
I would say that, you know, that's fair. Limiting. It's a very limited perspective and point of view. It's very shallow. It lacks depth.
So filmmaking aside, and She's Gotta Have It aside, is it a concept that he shouldn't just ever tackle because he's a man? Or
no, he can tackle it. It just needed to be done better.
Okay, so it's the execution.
Yes.
So in terms of that bad execution, are we saying that basically the filmmakers used a sledgehammer to drive their point home? And their point was Sharmeka exercised poor judgment, not just in how she did it, but in doing it in the first place.
Yes.
And they basically left no room for doubt in doing it, right? Like, everything was so extreme.
Right.
Everything, you know, from the actual procedure itself, mm-hmm, with that massive needle.
Yes.
And the really brutal nurse.
Yeah.
To the backroom nature of it, to the pain, the agony that Sharmeka was experiencing,
mm-hmm,
to the aftermath and the, you know, the, mm-hmm, disaster afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
It was all so grotesque and horror movie like,
right,
that they sort of left no room for doubt to say this is very, very bad.
Right.
So is that the judgment that you're talking about?
Right.
Yeah, I feel you. I feel you 100%.
Yes, that was the problem. This is the time when I said normally when he's didactic, he has a didactic approach. It typically hasn't bothered me in the past. Without exploring the depths of it, like you all were saying, without thinking about self-esteem, without thinking about the moment of arrival, mm-hmm, how we, mm-hmm, got here. Well, mm-hmm, suddenly to have a big booty is to situate you within a particular type of economy of beauty that we have not experienced. That's a new thing, you know, particularly when it's on non-Black women is when it's the most fetishized and the most interesting.
Exactly. Say that again, please. Because you know, again, we're at the point where on IG, you see all the European-American women booty goals.
Yeah.
How did we get here?
Like the squats, how can we get a booty?
Right. Yeah. Whereas before, when we were kids in the 80s, that was bad.
It was bad.
White girls didn't want to have
big
old butt
my whole life. And as a dancer, dancing and dance, you know, competition studios and all that, my ass was a problem.
Now you got girls in gyms killing themselves.
Yeah, to get a
booty.
And so like that would have been interesting for us to get there. I'm privy to these conversations where Black women who don't have a big booty, you know, they are...
feel less than,
right? And so but we don't get that. We get a little bit of that conversation when, mm-hmm, she's referring to
what she's painting. Mm.
So we get a little bit of that, but it would have been interesting to lead us to there. All of these things, like you all are saying, happens in an episode. You have 10. You have an opportunity to just take your time and develop.
Okay, so let me flip it on you guys for a second. How does that subplot and its episodes compare to the Little Black Dress episode?
I'm glad you brought that up.
Now, I'm not talking about the execution or writing in any kind of artistic context. If the overall message for the beauty standards plotline was one-sided, singular, and moralistic, how did the filmmakers approach the Little Black Dress episode compare to that? Did they allow that, for whatever reason, a greater range of views and opinions?
Yes. I thought the Little Black Dress was...
handled well.
I did. I thought the Little Black Dress was handled well. I don't know, especially in this climate and where we are, where, you know, the reckoning is happening and men are being called to the table for their misogyny and abuse of decades and decades. I thought it was well done. I also think that it demonstrated well how women, we have to take responsibility for your sexuality. Like, things are a lot of work. I mean, but this is the best way I can think about it. Like, you have something in your closet that I will choose to wear or not wear because the amount of work it's going to be for me to have to negotiate mm-hmm. the stares and the looks. Like, you absolutely have the right to wear whatever you want to wear. Mm-hmm. I am always going to support that. I 100% agree with it. And what I recognize now, what maybe I didn't recognize 20 years ago, was like to rock right. a little black dress like that, that's a lot of responsibility, because you look great and people are going to look at you, but you have to wear it knowing that you're going to have to negotiate comments, you're going to have to negotiate opinions, you're going to have to negotiate all these things. And the extent to which she was surprised by having to do those negotiations, you know what I mean? That to me was a little young, it was a little naive. Mm-hmm.
Well, she did it by intent or by circumstance. She was able to put the burden of having to negotiate her dress on Jamie when right. they go out to the restaurant, because it's Jamie
right.
that is now conscious about what she's got on, how people are looking at her, how people are looking at him. Mm-hmm. You know, two of his guys from his firm noticed mm-hmm. him, and she's not his wife, and he got to deal with all that, you right. know? That I thought that was handled really, really well.
Yes.
Greer, I didn't have any problem with any way the male suitors reacted, how that was handled
right.
story-wise.
Yes.
I thought the best of the three was Jamie, and I thought that Mars was a close second, because mm-hmm. what triggered Nola's ire toward Mars was when Mars was saying, "You gonna get a brother killed behind that dress."
Right, right.
And she took some real offense to that.
Right.
By saying, well, hey, everybody else has to deal with it. And Mars was trying to say, no, I have to deal with it. Because if I don't deal with it,
right.
you, Nola, would look at me as not being a man. So you put me in a box.
Right, right, right.
And I don't think Nola, he'll
look
character.
At, he'll look at himself as not being a man. The, as well.
That too. And yeah, right. yeah, yeah, that too. It's like, I have a responsibility now because you're with me.
Right.
To defend you if necessary.
Right.
I have that social responsibility. And I inherit. Responsibility. Okay. Episodically, that's probably the best example of what my point is about how Nola is the center in which she's got to have it really refers to these characters that navigate, that revolve around her and how they view her.
Mm-hmm. She's the story device for everybody else.
Yeah. Right. But I don't have a problem with that. Mm. It doesn't impede my enjoyment of the show.
Okay. All right.
You know what I'm saying?
Yes.
Also, how come everybody in Spike Lee movies, all the black people are living fly?
Well, I mean,
they all got dope apartments. I know, every movie.
I know.
And no one has to pay their rent on time.
Right. And everyone, but like that was what
that's
was.
Those are like $800,000-$900,000 cribs.
But they.
It's every film.
Yeah, every film.
Like Bleak Gilliam. I don't know any non-recording right. musician
right, right.
who's stuck in a bad contract. Can't renegotiate.
Who's married to a school teacher.
Getting bad money, but gets to live in a 5,000 square foot loft.
Right.
I thought one thing was very accurate in Insecure. Issa comes from a very middle class background.
Yeah,
nice. And ends up working for a non-for-profit. Her friend Molly comes from the hood mm-hmm. and ends up working for corporate America.
Right.
That's mm-hmm. very accurate.
That right. is.
A lot right. of people I know and have seen in real you mm-hmm. you can, you know, a lot of brothers and sisters that come from the hood, they're never going back, and they want to, you know, mm-hmm. they'll work in the highest echelons if they can, you know, if they can make it that far.
Right.
Whereas a lot of cats that come from middle class backgrounds go, you know, to the nonprofits and things like that. They didn't, at least in the episodes I saw, they didn't really make a big deal out of that, but it's something that you saw and they wove in this, they made it the foundation of their story.
Yeah.
And I thought that was very accurate.
Yeah, I think so too. I think it just goes to show how when you have privilege, you know, the comfort of privilege. So she has the opportunity to breathe and think about ways to contribute and give back that Molly, in a way, did not have mm-hmm. and did not strive towards. I think what's interesting that I appreciate about Insecure 2 is what Issa's apartment, that is an apartment in Inglewood mm-hmm. that...
That I have lived in.
The
yes,
dunes.
Thank you. That I have lived
yeah,
in.
The dunes.
You know, that you can afford by mm-hmm. working at a nonprofit where she's probably making $27,000 a year. And it's like right near the Jays, the jungles, or jungles adjacent.
Yeah, the jungle.
You know what I mean? Like that was realistic in a way, like what you all were saying, that these places that they're living in Fort Greene.
Yeah, I mean, in Spike's movies, there is that tendency for everyone to be living fly. It's like, how can, if you get 10 black folks together, are all of them going to be living fly? And there's everybody got a godmother or a sponsor. Mm-hmm. Come on now. It's like these cribs, those Fort Greene cribs, are some of those are $1 million cribs now. And maybe Mars was the only person that was living like in the hood.
Projects.
Everybody else was, you know, had a reason or a nice job or a reason for living that fly.
But you know what, though? In defense of Spike here, I got to say, when I was growing up, the vast majority of images of people of color on in TV shows and films was always showing them as criminal or destitute, etc. Spike was like one of the first to show affluence and aspiration and achievement.
Yes.
So you think this is reactionary?
Yeah, I mean, it meant a lot to me.
Yeah, he was the first one to put that dynamic on screen, following the Cosby Show, which was the first one to put that dynamic on the television.
I'll give him that, and I think
it was just beautiful to see. It had an impact on me.
Yeah, it is inspiring. I'll give him that, because some of those cribs is like, yo, I want to, you know, I do want to live like that. So it is, there is that nice feeling of seeing people of color in those environments.
Yeah, definitely, bro, definitely. So wait. Are we really gonna do this show and not talk about the music properly? Raquel, I see you're itching for this one. Let's go.
I'm like Spike. You know what? I know Maxwell. I know Mary J. Blige. I know Roberta Flack and Donny Hathaway. I don't need you to pop up the album cover every time an old school.
I think that may have been for the young kids.
It was for the young kids. Yeah. It was. So here's the deal. From the opening credit, one, two, I just smiled and eased in. Mm-hmm. I was so happy. I'm like,
it was a bit like coming home, wasn't it?
Yeah. I was like, that first. And so I was waiting throughout the whole thing, like, when is he really going to do an homage to Prince? Like, it has to happen.
Mm-hmm. Well, the first beat was
Raspberry Beret.
Yeah, the Raspberry Beret.
But Isaac, you haven't seen the finale, right?
No.
Oh.
So you don't know.
Yeah, it's good.
You need
You
know what? The thing is,
the mood just came way down.
It's like as much as we didn't like any of the album title cards and all of that. Uh-huh. It's like the way that he does it in this final scene is masterful.
No, but wait a minute.
Whoa!
No, wait. Arthur, I'm disappointed in you, bro. Mm.
Uh-oh.
They made a big mistake.
What happened?
See, she takes the record out of the sleeve for Around the World in a Day, the album, but the track that actually plays is Raspberry Beret, the extended remix, which isn't on the album.
Oh.
You should be disappointed in Spike.
Well, no, because I hold Arthur to a way higher standard than I do Spike.
I mean, if you really want to get down to it, when she puts the vinyl on the turntable and moves the needle over, she moves the needle far. She's basically playing tambourine. if you want to check my credentials.
Right. Either way, it's the wrong song, right?
I'm feeling you. But so, I mean, you know, don't, you know.
Yeah, don't check us on the Prince. I'm a Prince head too. I'm not a snob.
You know what I'm saying?
We're still good.
Because I'm like, oh, she's about to play tambourine. I'm like, what the fuck?
Yeah, it's not tambourine. The remix of Raspberry Beret.
I was all ready, man. I was set.
Yeah, like he's gonna really mix it up.
I love it when TMS creeps into SOF. Yeah. I love that shit.
Even with that moment, you know, I was like, would she really be into Prince like that?
Yeah, if it was hip to be,
So this is hard. So do we give away the whole ending?
Oh, yeah, we got a spoiler.
Yeah, we got a spoiler for it. I don't mind being spoiled.
Okay. So I was waiting for the big Prince moment. I'm like, there has to be. And I see it when she starts doing the Thanksgiving table and she lays out the guitars. I'm like, okay, so here comes the Prince moment. And then, but the part of me is like, would she really be into Prince like that at 27? You know, I don't buy that.
Not unless
She chose the most commercial Prince song. So.
The most commercial Prince song. And so that was interesting because this is all Spike, right? Like her talking about gentrification in Fort Greene is Spike. Her knowledge of basketball and
Akira, the movie, in the first episode.
The stuff that, you know, that he always throws out these things about films. Like this is all really, she's really Spike's voice. And then, you know, Greer shows up dressed as Prince, you know. So a lot of people are really pissed off about it. And I'm like, you know, as a Prince, as a Prince fan, like true blue.
True purple.
I was like, okay, this is the homage to Prince, so I can allow this and just let it be that. Because a lot of people are like, this is stupid. This would not happen. Three lovers would not show up at her crib, realize that they're the three lovers, and then hang and eat Thanksgiving dinner.
Not three brothers.
Not exactly. like so. Oh,
like
so
do a line dance.
And they're all very respectful and polite of each other, and
yeah, like yeah. People are like so. I'm like, okay, we have you're asking us to suspend reality there. So I'm gonna suspend this reality, and then these three black men, these who are her lovers, are gonna participate in dancing with her to a Raspberry Beret and all.
Are you saying
we're going to clap on the snare?
We wouldn't do that.
Not with two other men that are with someone.
Is that a violation of the man code?
You hit it. But this is what I'm wondering: is Nola Darling the character? Is she inspired? Is she the chick in Raspberry Beret?
Say that again.
You mean like why did he choose that song?
Nola Darling. Yes,
that's how I took.
Are you saying that? Are you saying
related to her in that
Raspberry
way?
Raspberry Beret inspired Spike to create Nola Darling.
Yes, did Raspberry Beret inspire the creation of Nola Darling?
No, I don't really think so. I think that if the lyrics to any Prince song were the inspiration for Nola Darling, it would have been Little Red Corvette.
Yeah.
So yeah, I don't think that's why he used Raspberry Beret.
Yeah, because Raspberry Beret chick isn't she sexually naive? Because that was her first time in Raspberry Beret, right?
No, it doesn't say that. It's the first time for both of them. In fact, he even says she knows how to get her kicks.
Yeah, because Little Red Corvette, she was, you know, he had to park the car sideways.
Yeah.
Because it wasn't going to last long. Greer probably parked sideways in front of Nola, right? In front of Nola's crib.
Wow.
She walked in through the outdoor. It might be Nola. That could be Nola.
I don't know, because there's no other male involved.
She's not
I'm
dumb, though. Nola's intelligent, though.
Is she?
But I'm kind of with Jay. I think though more raspberry, but you know, hey, inspiration doesn't have to be whole cloth. He might have got parts of, you know.
It just made me wonder if like
you give him a lot of credit.
I'm like
he's also reminiscing.
He's obviously, you know, very much entranced by at least commercial Prince. Maybe not deep Prince.
Really, he should have played Chocodelica.
That's what I'm saying. He may not be deep Prince, but Spike is very influenced by commercial Prince. He always has been.
Deep Prince though. Mm-hmm. I think he's deep Prince.
I don't know because he I think he's played so much. I think even in Girl 6 he played a lot of surface cuts. It's like, dude,
to be fair to him, he probably also played what Prince approved.
Because Prince was involved. Playing. Yeah,
Prince weren't like letting, you know, like
that was what year was that? That was
96, 90. No. What 96? More like 94. Yeah. Girl 6 came out in 94. Well, shout out to Spike for putting the Prince photo at the end. Fabulous photo. Best photo you could probably use in a scenario like that.
Yes. The fro.
All right. Snobs on Film.
We're never
full
happy,
lid.
Basically. We're never happy.
No, absolutely not. That's why we are Snobs on Film. Where can you be found online?
I'm on Twitter and I'm on Instagram. And I think if you just type, because I don't know my handles on those things. It may be Rockbox19, ROCBOX19, but I think it's Raquel Monroe. Like if you type in my name, RAQUEL Monroe, MONROE. You can find me on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram by using my name.
Isaac Perry.
You can find me on Instagram and Twitter at Isaac Perry, ISAAC. And if you want to learn more about me, you can go to isaacperry.com.
Jay, first of his name?
Yeah, you can find me on Twitter at Jahan's Dream and at Total Music Snobs. And if I'm not on Twitter, I'll be on Alphabet Street.
Obviously.
Definitely check out at Snobs on Film on Twitter and Instagram. And hit us with questions. Hit us with...
And hate mail.
And hate mail. Hit us with anything you want us to talk about. Hit us up. We're going to have a mailbag starting soon. So.
I think I'll open up the comments on the website.
Yeah, so we want to get your feedback and your insights and... your questions, most of all, things that we can address on the show. So hit us up at Snobs on Film, Twitter and Instagram.
Arthur Turnbull.
Oh, yeah.
Where can people find the notorious Arturo?
My Twitter handle is Arthur, but I spell it ARRTHURR.
Ah.
Neat, huh?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. See how he do?
Smart. Yeah. Smart.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a homage to my mom. My mom used to sing my name.
You never told me that. That is dope. How are you holding that back all this time? I've been wondering why the hell.
Every she called me, she'd be like, Arthur.
See, that's a dope story.
Love it.
I'm full of them. You never asked me questions. Y'all got me as the host.
I've never gotten beneath the surface. I've never got behind the surface. I've known you for 20 years and I've been like.
Yeah, that's why they're double R.
Yeah, it's dope. That's dope.
So I want to thank everybody for being with us today. This was a great, great conversation.
Thank you for letting me sit at the table.
Thank you for letting us discuss booty in a safe
safe environment.
We have not been able to freely discuss booty and be able to release the conversation in such a correct manner. All right, that's a wrap for this episode of Snobs on Film. And we invite you to subscribe to the show in iTunes or Google Play or your favorite podcast aggregator. We can be reached online at snobsonfilm.com. Our Twitter and our Instagram handles are both Snobs on Film. We're going to see you next show.
I liked Insecure a lot more than I liked She's Got to Have It a lot more.
Mm-hmm.
On pretty much every level, to be honest with you.
What the hell? But, John, I'm sorry.
John, my computer just switched to my screensaver.
And it's ass.
I didn't realize that.
You went away, John. And
Isaac has been unmasked.
Ass appeared. My... Oh... Know who you are now. It's okay.
In my defense, it's not ass. It's a very artistic shot of a woman emerging out of water, looking over a skyscraper.
There's nothing artistic about it. It could be in Playboy.
It was funny because it just switched. Like it was like you were talking and the computer just slid over to the side. It was like,
right. Like the computer was like, nah, nigga.
Not you. Not you.
That's what you are. It's really what you want. Let's get this out. Arthur said, cards on the table. Well,
yeah. right.
Boom!
That was fun.
The Batcave has spoken.
Right.